Welcome back. We're into the last hour of the show. Thanks for all your comments coming in. I will get to many of them in a moment. But I want to speak to David first, because we're talking about Bonkrana. Hi, David. Good morning to you. Thank you for your time today.
Hello.
It's Greg here, David. Can you hear me? Hello, David.
Can you hear me?
I can, yes. It's Greg here. You were going to talk about road safety in Bonkrana.
Yeah. I have a water called, I'm sitting here in the car in Bonkrana at the minute. There's a white van parked on the pedestrian crossing. You just parked there now. I was coming up Bonkrana Street yesterday, and there was a lorry parked on the pedestrian crossing. And there was three children come out from the front of the lorry. I never even looked where they were going. If I hadn't seen them coming down the van, it would have been in hospital.
Well, how does that work in terms of, say, for instance, you know, people in a wheelchair or pushing a buggy using the drop curb?
Same thing. I've got on to two of our councillors to get these crossings marked the same as they done out the Cockhull Road, black and white, and no parking at any time route across them. But now this has come back nearly a year ago. I got on to the councillors. Both of them promised me to get something done, and nothing was done. I can name the councillors if you want to.
No, that's not necessary. Are these what you might describe, David, as courtesy crossings, where they're not black and white lines, they're just a different colour?
They're just tar. Yeah. That's all they are, black tar. Black tar with humps on them. And the first time I went to them, they said, they're not crossings, they're camel measures.
Right.
And I said, you know the ties they put down, Craig, for the visually impaired and the blind, the bubble tiles, so let them know where the crossing is.
Yeah.
They're in both sides of them.
Right, that indicates they're crossings then.
That's it.
Well, especially if you're using a stick, though. I'm saying if you're using a stick, what have you, I presume that indicates somewhere where you can cross.
Yeah, exactly. That tells them that's a crossing. Now, if they come up and them bubble ties is there and lorry's parked on top of the crossing, what do they do? Somebody in a wheelchair comes across, what do they do?
Or if a kid runs out behind a lorry or a van thinking that...
Same happened yesterday. I was coming up the street yesterday and I seen the kids coming down. They were on their phones, didn't lift their heads at all. They just walked straight out in front of the lorry.
All right. David, listen, we're going to get in contact with the powers that be to see what the story is. If you are in the Bonkrana area or you often use that road and you want to back up David and what he's saying, please get in touch. 086 60 25,000. A caller says, just picked up in what Mr. Kelly said about the famine. Let's not call it famine anymore. Let's call it the British genocide of the Irish instead. We know all that food and poultry leaving Ireland for England happened and let the Irish starve. Not denying there was a potato blight, but was it an opportunity for the British to do it the way with the Irish people? Dr. Kelly, acutely aware of that. We've discussed it in the past. But just to timeline something, it's most commonly known as the famine. Unless I heard your guest wrong, O'Connell was not supportive of the 1798 or 1803 rebellions. During the 1798 rebellion, he was a member of the Loyal Artillery Corps as British militia responsible for hunting down the United Irishmen. Several years later, he actually suggested that Robert Emmet should have been hanged. O'Connell was all about himself and the wealthy Catholic elite and should be remembered as such. He wanted us to become West Britons. At the time, Engels said this about O'Connell. O'Connell did not really mean to achieve repeal, since he uses the impoverished, oppressed Irish people to embarrass the Tory ministers and to help his middle-class friends to get back into office. Well, listen, I mean, obviously we can't dig down into every moment in the history of O'Connell in that short period of time, but I would imagine reading your comments there that your views and Dr. Kelly's are more aligned than maybe you first thought when you text in. Really appreciate the text in. Love to have you engaged. Love to talk history, but especially when it sparks debate and conversation, because it is our heritage. Greg, can you find out why the Income Tax Office in Letterkenny will not take calls, although their website says they are open? Is it a centralised number now, I wonder? Let me dig into that. Do you know if anyone in Donegal has a Padre Pio glove? Can you please text me details? Well, we have numbers if this person wants to call us. The shop, St. Paul's in Letterkenny, has it on certain days. So give us a call back. We have a list and it's easier for us to pass that info on to you that way. Re-car parks. It should be compulsory that all car parks should have a 45 degree angle parking instead of a straight one. This would save a lot of wasted fuel trying to line up by reversing into a straight angle. All right, that's interesting. When are the lights on the Castle Bridge, Castlefin Bridge going to be fixed? Another caller with the same question. We have a question into the council. So as soon as we know, you will know. I live in Ballybofane. We have a Tidy Towns adjudication coming up shortly. There is an event coming up in the town, but they have covered derelict buildings with posters. These posters will be an absolute eyesore. I'd appeal for these businesses. We love to see you in town, but please respect our town. A caller says people get very lazy. I'm on the road every day and I also see people pulling up in petrol stations alongside the pumps without getting in fuel just to get their bits and pieces. God forbid if they had to walk an extra 20 or 30 feet. I pull up beside the pumps and I don't pull away from the pumps until I've gone in and paid, because it's almost as if the default is that you're a criminal and you're about to run off with their petrol or diesel because the signs are everywhere, CCTV and operational. I'm too scared to pull away. So maybe I'm the person sitting at the pumps whilst I'm in paying and getting a few bits and bobs. Connor Houston is Northern Ireland Director, Vulcan Consulting, founder and MD of Connor Houston, Houston Associates. He joins us on the show now. Hi, Connor.
Hi, Greg. How are you? Good morning.
I'm doing good. I'm doing good. And the question is, what's it like to lose an election? And you can answer that. Before we get to that point, where do you have to be in, or what makes you want to seek public office? Is it something within yourself? You have a bit of it and maybe there's a party approaches you and says, look, we can support you. We can tease it out with you. Like, talk to me about your journey into wanting to become an elected politician.
Sure. I think it's about trying to make a difference, make a contribution to society. So really going back to when I was probably a teenager, Greg, I had an interest in politics, in how you could make a difference within the community that you live in. I followed politics. I was involved in a lot of community groups, a lot of civic groups, and I suppose a part of a generation that was really trying to realise the potential of the Good Friday Agreement. I've had a really amazing career. I've been very lucky. I've been a lawyer. I've been on a number of really incredible civic organisations, think tanks, and I suppose all of those experiences came together in sort of a desire to stand for public office. I wanted to bring my skills and insights and try and make a difference to the place that I'm proud to call home.
Did you feel that if elected into office, you could actually make a difference? Because, I mean, I presume part of the reason that drove you to politics was frustration at things never seeming to change or nothing ever happening. Did you believe that if elected, you actually could be that change? And do you still feel that way?
Well, I absolutely did. I wouldn't have put myself forward if I didn't believe I had a contribution to make or I couldn't make a difference. And I suppose through my roles in business and civic society, I have been able to affect change. You know, one of the positions I held, Greg, for example, I was chair of a special school in Belfast. You know, I know in the 3 years that I was chair of that school, I got to see how I can make a real difference, nudge the dial and make an impact. And so I wanted to bring those insights, those skills and that experience to public life. So I absolutely, people can get very frustrated by the politics and the political system, but I was very keen to see what I could do to make a difference.
And I suppose my question could have sounded loaded. Let's be realistic though. For instance, we have a peace in Northern Ireland now, which we often take for granted that would not have been achieved without politics, without politicians, without people getting around tables. So I presume that was part of your inspiration.
Of course. I was a teenager at the time of the Good Friday Agreement, and I remember vividly the sort of what I felt. I was only 14, 15, and I remember feeling that politics could be hopeful. The seemingly impossible could be done when people work together. I was inspired by, we were so fortunate, as you know, in this part of the world, we had the likes of John Hume, David Trimble, Monica McWilliams, so many others who made huge sacrifices in order to help bring about the peace that we now enjoyed. And I felt a responsibility, even as a teenager, to try to find ways to ensure that peace lasted. We sort of take for granted that it has lasted, but that is because of a lot of hard work by both politicians, people in business society, civic society, on the in grassroots community groups, really day in, day out working at the peace. And that's something that I'm very proud to have spent a lot of my adult life working on. I think the big lesson is doing the peace agreement is nearly the easy part. It's a changing hearts and minds is a sort of a generational piece of work.
And it is. And that's why it's important there is never a political value vacuum, because often if you see some of the flare-ups, I think anyway, and you can correct me if you believe different, over the last 10 or 15 years, it is often where there is a political vacuum or where there perhaps is not enough political leadership. Change, societal change does take generations, but very quickly I think you can see, you know, tinder spots when there are those political vacuums, or it feels like there isn't political representation there.
Not to overly simplify it, but I think you could say in the last 28 years since the peace agreement, when people have worked together in a common good, we have made huge progress. When the British and Irish governments work together, when the political parties in Stormont have worked together, we have made leaps and bounds as a society. When those relationships are fractured, as happened during Brexit, unfortunately then progress stalls. So the simple lesson is you've got to keep building those relationships. You've got to keep working those relationships and not taking them for granted. And that's where in politics and in civil society, I've spent a lot of time trying to build those relationships, particularly across the political spectrum, my friends right across all the parties in Northern Ireland. I think that's hugely important to find ways to, as I always say, disagree well, because that's how you can ultimately build a more reconciled society and a society where we value that diversity and difference and where we can make progress.
Yeah, it's very important to speak to people, I think, to talk. And it amazes me, very intelligent people that I have a lot of respect for in the left of politics and the right of politics don't want to hear the other voice.
Yeah,
it's and they can say for whatever reason they want to do, but the truth is they simply don't want to hear the voice. And how in God's name can you get anywhere if you don't? And sometimes that's to platform it so to the point whereby it's completely unacceptable point of view. And I'm not saying anything that would actually genuinely, you know, directly offend an individual or whatever. But there is no exclusivity on wanting your opposition to shut up in politics.
Yeah, I think I completely agree with you, Greg. And it's one of the things I've noticed, I think, particularly in the last 5 years, maybe post-COVID, that sort of much more divided sense. I mean, you see that with sort of the Trump America at the minute. Politics is very divisive, very toxic.
But it's a horseshoe. Yeah. It's a horseshoe. The left and the right meet in the middle.
And if
either side of that don't see that, well, they're pretty naive as intelligent as they might think they are.
Unfortunately, the culture, and I suppose of what might be called the Good Friday Agreement generation, the lesson of the Northern Ireland Irish peace process was people being able from very different backgrounds working together in a common good. We need more of that. We need to bring that ethos back to politics. This sort of cancel culture that if you don't completely agree with an ideological point of view, you're wrong, you're discredited is not healthy. It's actually really good in a democracy to have people that you disagree with.
But I think people that know better, people that should know better, who could be the leaders or the brokers, have succumbed to exactly what you just talk of. You're very active in your community. Sorry, you're from Belfast, are you?
I'm from a little town just outside Belfast called Hollywood.
Okay, so you're doing great work in there. You're involved in local schools. You're involved in community. I mean, you are making a difference on the ground. But if you step into politics as you chose to do, you know, firstly, you're going to have to forego some of that work. Secondly, dependent on who you stand for, maybe you might not be welcome in certain places. So in a way, you know, it was a big shout for you to say, right, firstly, I'm going to dedicate my life to trying to achieve this. But also you had to say, right, I'm going to have to at least park the work, if not remove it altogether, and see if I can achieve more in a different space. That's a toying cost, is it?
Yeah, well, I think for me, as with everything I've done in my career, I believe you have to go all in. You've got to make those sacrifices. You've got to focus to achieve your goals. So I gave up really a year of my life to campaign, build my pro and run for election and run the campaign.
For the SDLP in the end.
For the SDLP.
You found they most aligned to your way of...
Yeah, I think, well, I was very fortunate. My dad's a dairyman. My grandfather had a shoe shop in Derry, Bernard Houston, and he was great friends with John Hume. So I kind of grew up steeped in that SDLP sort of ethos. I had a lot of friends, Colm Eastwood and Claire Hannah, were people I greatly admired. So I felt it was the best political home for me, and the values of the SDLP sort of chime with myself. And that's something that I was very proud to stand with the SDLP.
And in terms of once you've made that decision and your family have to come with you and all of that kind of stuff, what was one of the biggest eye-openers? I mean, because you're stepping from... not obscurity, obviously, because you're very well known into your in your own community, but you're stepping into a realm where all bets are off. Anyone can say anything about you. Your opponents, if they feel threatened by you, can say absolutely anything they like. You'll not always get your right to reply. You are now just in the game. What was that like?
I think the hardest thing was what I would call the sort of the box culture. And it was because I was in the SDLP, therefore Nationalist Party, you would very quickly get put in a box. And I think the shock for me was twofold. One was the level of sectarianism, unfortunately, that still exists within society, and people would kind of just discredit anything I had to say on the basis that they could put this nationalist label on me. That was difficult, because I've spent my whole life trying to promote a shared, reconciled society. The second then, of course, is, and I think anybody who stood for office, anybody that's in politics will tell you, social media. It's a very, on one hand, it's brilliant because you get to communicate directly with the voter in a very personal way. You can be in their homes, sharing your videos, sharing your messages, and people were great at interacting. And 90% of my social media was very positive, very engaging. People got behind the campaign. Unfortunately, then you have the anonymous on social media who use it for nefarious, to spread hate and to be hateful. And unfortunately, like many people in public life, I suffered from abuse online, and unfortunately at times threats online, which had to be reported to police. So that was the difficult thing, because at the end of the day, all you're trying to do is step up and serve your community, make a contribution, make a difference. And so that sort of very small, just a stretch, very, very small element.
It's impossible to ignore, and it only takes one person, obviously, to do something that could be quite drastic. Curious, did you knock on every door, or just every door that would be favourable to you or an SDLP candidate?
I knocked on every door, and I was very, from the outset when I was designing the campaign, I made very clear, look, of course there are areas where we knew we had a strong vote. Did I focus on those areas? Of course I did. But I was very clear to my team that this, I want to represent everybody in this constituency. I want to knock in communities where we don't necessarily get a vote, because I think it's very important to listen to people. Why aren't they voting for you? And I was very proud when I looked at the results and I looked at the different boxes. I got votes right across the constituency. I got a phenomenal rate of transfers from people from the unionist tradition. In fact, a lot of people who backed my campaign publicly would be considered unionists. So that was very, very important to me, to genuinely stand and represent and ask for the vote of everybody in the constituency, because I would have wanted to represent everybody in the Strangford constituency.
Obviously, we're having to fast forward to some extent, but I mean, you put in a long campaign and you enjoyed a lot of backing. So we'll fast forward to polls day, but I just want to get an insight into how personal the journey feels, or how responsible you feel for your team. Because, obviously a party will get behind you, but a party is a party, but it takes individuals, people that say, right, I'm backing you here. I believe you can make that difference. And you had those in great numbers. How much pressure was there on you to deliver for yourself? Obviously, your constituents, that's the aim of the game, but also those that sort of backed you, because it's a very personal endorsement.
It is, yeah. I mean, I always tell the story. One of the doors I knocked, there was a young mother with two children, came to the door. It was a January evening, and the cold came out of the house. There was no lights on. And, you know, the kids were sitting with their coats on the sofa, and I realized this is why I'm running. This is why we need to step up. But yes, you do. You feel a huge responsibility for your team, for the people who back you. One of the extraordinary things that happens when you put yourself up for election is that all these people sort of emerge seemingly from nowhere who get behind your campaign. There was one young guy called Will, and I don't think I went out on a canvas where he didn't come out with me. I mean, I'd never met the guy before I went into politics, and he basically dedicated 9 months of his life to getting behind me. But then so many people put up my posters, people fundraise for me, people come out and leaflet with me. So, you know, you do feel a responsibility. The media then were getting behind my campaign. There was kind of this sense of history making. And so it was, and I got some sort of celebrity endorsements from actors like the actor Jimmy Nesbitt and rugby player Andrew Trimble. So there was a kind of a momentum, and you feel then a pressure and responsibility. And you, look, being honest, you buy into it, of course, because you feel this surge.
But you've done everything you possibly can. And I think it's like playing a game of football or any sport or whatever it is. You don't want to leave anything on the pitch, so to speak. And I think your campaign, you could assess it and you say, no, I did not. Unfortunately, when you're in a count centre, and I've been in many, thankfully, not standing for election, it's a room full of people that will be successful or unsuccessful. And success also is measured in different ways. For some, success is not necessarily even getting elected. It might be to increase their votes or to have their... But you did run for election with a view to getting elected. So when it began to emerge, you were in the race, out the race, in the race, out the race, and eventually you fell short by 40 votes. Is that worse than losing by 3,000 votes?
I'm not sure, because I haven't experienced, thankfully, that loss. But it was a long count. In my account, actually, I think might have been one of the longest in that assembly election. It went over 2 days, and we were ahead for seven counts. So it was pretty brutal in that regard. And it's hard, because 40 votes feels like, you know, if I just done one more night, if I just done one more village again, could I have tipped that the other way? But that's the way it works. And the count centre is a very surreal place. You know, it's a goldfish bowl, and, you know, it's like applying for a job in the full glare of the media, and people are watching in real time your success or your failure in terms of getting elected. So that pressure was huge. I was very lucky. I had an amazing campaign manager, one of my best friends, Gareth, and my dad was there, and obviously all my team. So, and the party were brilliant. So I felt very supported, but it was still there's no way of hiding. You don't do all that. You don't give up a year. You don't move house. You don't do all these things to not win. So that was very hard.
How long did it take after defeat, as you framed it yourself, how long did it take to come around? People will say you gave it a good run. You should be proud of yourself. Brilliant. People will say this, that, and none. We're proud of you, blah. But at the end of the day, you sacrificed a great deal with a view to getting elected into politics, which you weren't successful in. So how, not even what you were saying to other people, how long did it take you to come to terms with that?
You know, honestly, it's always something you never really get over, you know, these things in life, in the sense that, you know, it was a life-defining moment. I suppose what I did that summer, you know, that was in May, and really over the course of that summer, I probably licked the wounds and I felt a bit sorry for myself. But I dug deep, and I had a lot of support still around me, a lot of great friends and family. And, you know, what really emerged to me, the big lesson was, well, actually, I stood for what I believe, and I stood for my values. I acted with integrity.
Well, on that point, if you were able to forego a little bit of integrity, if you were able to perhaps not be as honest as you chose to be, or perhaps maybe not being as polite to your opposition as maybe you were, do you believe that you could have got elected if you had have been less authentic and had less morals?
Who know? I mean,
you,
who know?
You know, but that's why I'm asking.
That was just never on the cards, you know, look, throughout my career.
But I'm trying to get an insight into what I'm trying to get an insight into is, it's there's come a point where a candidate might have to sacrifice what's important to them to succeed in politics. That greasy pole, you will eventually do whatever it takes to get on it.
there are tactics in elections and in political processes where you can demonize, for example, your opposition. And I just refuse to go down that route. Now, it's a what if I had, would it maybe have got me those 40 votes to keep me in the race and maybe get the seat? I don't know. But I just think that, it's such a personal test of your values, of your credibility, of your integrity. And the one thing that even today I am so proud of is I didn't compromise those. Mm. And I think in life, that's what it's about, because you never compromise your values or integrity.
It's a two-part question. My final question for you, I suppose, what did you learn about politics and what did you learn about yourself in the process?
Well, I think the politics one was the number of just amazing people that enter the public arena. There's across the political spectrum. There's people who, like me, have made the sacrifices, who want to make a difference. Also, the amazing people I met. When you knock thousands of doors, you get a real sense of your community and society. And as I said, most people are just decent and want to live a good life and have a better life for their kids. It's fairly simple at the end of the day. So I had a huge respect for politics and for the community I live in. For myself, I think it goes back to what I was just talking about. It really crystallizes who you are, what you stand for, what your values are, your integrity. And that's something I'm so grateful for, because that stood me. I went on to become chief executive of the SDLP and did that for 2 years. And now I'm back in the business world working in consulting. And, those values, that integrity are what makes me continue to want to make a difference. And I hope to be successful.
If you really, really, really cared about someone in your life and they said to you, I'm thinking of running for the SDLP in the next election, would you say, yes, do it, I'll back you 100%? Or, you know what, maybe stick to community work?
I would never discourage anybody from running for public office.
Would you
but
encourage?
I think it's always very personal as a politician's answer.
I haven't shook that yet.
I would never discourage anyone from running for public office. It's an extraordinary, but as I'm outlining, and I think that's why I was quite surprised by the reaction. I wrote this blog just to kind of share some thoughts on my LinkedIn, and it kind of has attracted a lot of attention. I think it's like anything you commit to in life. If you're going to make any big leap, there's going to be sacrifices, there's going to be risks. And I think just so long as people are aware of those, I would say go for it. And I have no regret. I wish I'd won, but I have absolutely no regret in doing it.
Lovely stuff. Thanks so much for your time, Connor. Best of luck
in the business
world. Would you ever consider running again?
I definitely will give a politician's answer now, Craig. For now, I'm very happy where I am. I'm enjoying being back sort of in business civic life. I know I can make a real difference here, but I would never rule it out.
Okay,
public
thanks.
Public service is the highest calling, so I'd never rule it out.
Thank you so much for your time. That's Connor Houston there. And he wrote a blog on LinkedIn called What's It Like to Lose an Election? And I thought it interesting to have a quick chat with him to just get that insight. Caller says the parking spaces at Dunn Stores are far too narrow. If anyone has an ailment or needs an aid, I don't know how they can get out of their car. The parking spaces, they reiterate, are too narrow. Yeah, it seems to be a thing. I think everyone's now driving bigger cars, or it seems like everyone's driving bigger cars, SUVs, even SUVs, with 1 litre or 1.3 litre engines, which normally would have went into a smaller car. And I just think these lines were painted when the majority of people weren't driving those type of cars. And I think it comes down to that. Another caller says the reason that people get away with parking in the disabled bay in Letterkenny's main street is because there is no Garda presence on the main street. If the Gardaí were there to police it, there would be no issue. But you've got traffic wardens, that's part of their job as well. And there are numbers, I believe, that you can call. And can you take pictures? I'm not sure. I'll have to double check that. But anyway, you can do your bit as well. Now, Myra Ní Warahu is CEO of Irish Self Catering Federation. And is with me on the program now. Good morning, Myra.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm doing fabulous. It's great to have you on. Right, you're part of a group representing self-catering rental homes. And you're unhappy with what's been described as scapegoating for the housing crisis. So when we talk about self-catering rental homes, is this Airbnbs in layman's terms?
You could call it Airbnb, but
not
we were here a long time before Airbnb.
Yeah, I get you.
Yeah. So Airbnb is only in the market for just over 10 years in Ireland. And the term has been used, but self-catering has been there since about the 1950s or 60s.
So you've got a person's lucky enough to have a second house or a part of their house, and they want to make an income from it. Previously, they might have stuck a poster up in the supermarket, but now they can use platforms like Airbnb. These are the people that we're talking about. And now we are having planning regulations, really, that's encroaching on your right to do with your property what you wish.
And that's true, Greg. So there are two things coming down the tracks for us. The first thing is that we have a register for short-term rental. That's been brought in by the EU. Because we don't have a register at the moment. The government has no idea how many self-catering properties there are. But the register is very much to be welcomed because it'll give clear data on how many properties there are. However, they're also bringing in planning requirement for all of us in the industry. And many of us run small mom and pop businesses all over rural Ireland, all over Donegal. We may have converted an outhouse, a shed, part of the house, and they're now expecting that all of us will get planning.
The truth is it's not so you get planning. It's so that what you're doing can be not criminalised, but it can be made illegal. Listen, let's call it as it is in certain areas, and it's areas with a population of over 10,000, this is about stamping out short-term lets. It's not about making life difficult for you to apply. It's a mechanism for the state to control these properties.
Completely. You've gotten one, Greg. So in Donegal, Letterkenny would be the only place that would be affected. And we're saying they are using like a sledgehammer to crack a nut. They're using regulations which have been brought in places like Barcelona, which is 1.6 million, to deal with Letterkenny. And that's not fair because there is no comparison between Letterkenny and the tourism population of Barcelona.
What kind of an impact is it felt this might have on, let me focus on rural Ireland. As you mentioned, Letterkenny is the town affected in this part of the world, but right down the West Coast, the Midlands and the East Coast as well, there are thousands upon thousands of these types of properties. What do you believe the impact might be? And I just want to put it into context too. We're also discussing at the same time hotels gouging people and discouraging tourists into this country, because I think that feeds into this story to some extent as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's worth about $250 million per annum in rural Ireland directly for the rentals. And separate to that, for every €25 that's been spent on a rental, €75 is spent in the local community on self-catering in the restaurants, the cafes, the shops, the activity providers, the visitor attractions. People will spend a lot more money when they're staying in self-catering than they do in hotels. It's cheaper, it's family-centred, it's family-focused, and therefore it brings a huge amount of income to rural Ireland. And we depend on that income. And the government basically is trying to close down rural Ireland by bringing in this very retrograde legislation.
If we had a surplus of social housing and public-built housing, I presume you're of the feeling that this would not happen, that this your sector is being seen as a solution to the housing crisis, which some would say has been caused by a failure of government. So the government, who perhaps aren't meeting the targets, are saying, right, instead of us meeting those targets, we're going to develop more rental property from your sector.
Exactly. So they expect that we're going to turn around and say, OK, you can take our properties, you know, no problem. However, they need most of the accommodation in high density urban areas, not in rural areas of Donegal. And so what we're saying is hands off our properties. We're very happy with the register. We want a register in place, but we cannot be expected to get, you know, apply for planning again and get it in before May of next year. It's physically impossible. You know what the planning system is like. It can take years to get planning. We all already have these buildings in place. We are running our businesses. And government has a lot of properties. It's got over 3,000 social housing properties that are empty at the moment. The OPW has over 700 properties which are empty, and the HSE has large buildings such as hospitals all sitting empty, over 230 of those. So what we're saying is government needs to focus on what they have, not try and go for the quickest, easiest solution and try and take our properties.
Yeah, I mean, broadly speaking, you know, I mean, obviously even those not affected by this, and this might sound like I'm anti it, and I'm not saying that because it's not for me to say, but, you know, at this point, what we're saying is let's introduce policies that determine what a private person can do with their private property. So maybe you were lucky enough to inherit it, or maybe you ended up with it and you're an accidental landlord, or maybe it's your pension pot, maybe it's your investment, maybe it's your security. What we're saying is that you can't use it for the function that you wish to use it, even though there's a tax dividend and what have you for the state. We're actually going to position it to a point whereby we're going to choose what you use this property for. So you either sell it to someone who will comply with what we want, or you actually change the use of this property in and of itself. I think when a state sort of reaches that far into people's personal ownership, I think we need to all sort of say, is this what we want? I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but I think everyone, because it could be this next. Next, in 20 years, it could be two people living in a five-bedroomed house, you know, that the state thinks, well, why can we not move a family in there? And you could be discouraged from having three spare rooms in your own house. We you know, this is, we're on the same potential pathway, and that's why I think, whether people agree or disagree, have a think about what we're talking about, because I think it's slightly greater, with all due respect to the safe catering sector, it's slightly greater than that potentially.
It is. It has a serious effect. And I mean, the basic problem is the government is not building social housing. They haven't built it for many years. They're taking an idea from a policy that is developed in Spain, where they were restricting the short-term rent, the Airbnbs particularly, not all short-term rental, but Airbnb. And they were turning around to bring that policy into Ireland. The only thing they're not doing is they're not building any houses themselves. So the government needs to understand that if they bring in a policy, they've actually got to carry it through and build the social housing and provide...
Well, I mean, they are going to deliver they are going to deliver 35, 36,000 houses, but listen, that's far short of where we need to be. Okay, yeah. It's an interesting one. I think the problem is that I have heard politicians, individuals, or collective groups of politicians, i.e. parties, in opposition in favour of this, wanting Airbnbs taxed out of it effectively. So it's going to be interesting to see where your support might fall, because it's not by default coming from the opposition this time. But anyway, it's been interesting hearing your views, Myra. I do appreciate your time. As I say, this doesn't affect me directly. I don't have a second house. But anyway, I do appreciate your time. Myra Ní Wuruhu, what do you think? 086 60 25,000. As I say, you know, I mean, we need more houses. You know, I know there are people in this county living in freezing cold, substandard houses. They've nowhere to go. There's no rent. They can't afford the rent because they can't compete with schemes that are out there for the Ukrainian people, for an example, no begrudging of them. We have a massive housing crisis. There are thousands upon thousands of these houses all around the country. Maybe it is time to bring them back into full-time use. As I say, I don't know the answer to that, but also to one has to consider, whilst it might not affect you now, what happens down the line in 20 years' time if you and your partner are living in a 4 or 5-bedroomed house and you are deciding what to do with it, but you're told that, well, that house is too big for you. That house could, you could house a family of 8 there. There's a little apartment, move into that. Maybe it won't be your choice. Maybe you'll be taxed out of that too. I don't know. But I just think it's very important that we talk about it. I'm not scaremongering. I'm not taking a side. I just think we need to have that broader conversation. Let me know what you think. 086 60 25,000. The phone lines have been incredibly busy. We have another set of figures out. They seem to come fast. They're embargoed until 12 o'clock. So we can't really speak about them, but I'll not be back on air for another 12 hours. And my understanding is and what I expect us to be doing really, really well again with our listeners, not only on this show, but right across the station 7 days a week. And it is fantastic. It's a great testament to our listeners, if I'm correct, but also to our fantastic advertisers who we support, and they support us, and they keep the lights on and all that kind of stuff. So as I say, not preempting it because it's embargoed to 12, but hopefully there's good good news later on, and we'll be able to talk about it in a little bit more detail tomorrow. Though by the time tomorrow's come, I'll be over it and probably forget to even mention it. Oh, we're coming from Rafo tomorrow, by the way. Is it in a public building, Caroline? Are we in a public building? So if you're in and around Rafo, call over and say hello. We've had some great turnouts recently in the likes of Dunloe, Carndonagh. Rafo people, don't leave us hanging. We'd love to say hello. Maybe you want to bring the kids along and let them see how a radio show actually goes on. We're more than happy to see you. I'll give you some more details about what we're doing tomorrow after we take a break. Delighted to welcome onto the programme now Seamus Boland, who's CEO of Irish Rural Link. Good morning, Seamus.
Good morning. Nice to be there.
Yeah, now, we've had a number of texts, as I imagine many people have, from people concerned because they've received letters from Revenue, their pensioners, and it's in relation to incorrect tax payments. Some, the majority being told that they've underpaid, some being told they overpaid. So what has led to this? Is this people with a public and private pension that primarily are receiving this contact?
Yeah, primarily it's people basically who have occupational pensions. That's pensions linked to their jobs, linked to their employment, whether it's private or public. So they may be in a situation where, for various reasons, that occupational pension doesn't seem to have been declared. And as a result, if you earn more than 18,000, any citizen, then you're due for tax. So older people are no exception. And I think that's the reason why people are now getting these letters and indeed are concerned.
Am I correct in saying the state pension isn't taxed, and that may be as led to some confusion?
Yeah. First of all, if you're just receiving a state pension, it's the most it can be is €15,000. And since the taxation limit for tax purposes is 18, you're way below that. So anybody on a state pension, you won't have got letters and you've nothing to worry about.
People may have presumed that, you know, if there was no contact from Revenue, that everything was all right. Surely they know if I'm in receipt of a contributory pension and a state pension. And, you know, do you think, that ignorance isn't a defence, right? But do you think maybe people are justified in presuming the state knew everything that was going on?
Yeah, now we're coming to the crux of the matter. I remember in 2012, the revenue wrote to 115,000 pensioners, and it caused enormous confusion because they didn't know whether they were paying tax on the state pension. They didn't know what was going on. And indeed, there was an apology made by the revenue at that time at the confusion and anxiety created. And I suppose what we all thought was that at that time, revenue and various other aspects of government had resolved this issue because everybody has a PRSI number. So therefore, it should be relatively easy to devise a system whereby, you know, the income, especially from pensions, whether it be occupational or not, can be seen. And therefore, the necessary deduction of tax happens. But clearly, that has not happened. And I think that's what I would really ask questions about. And you're right, a lot of people are concerned at these letters because they quite frankly don't know what to do. And this is the second time this has happened. And I think once is kind of understandable, but twice is just going out of hand.
And even those, we've been contacted by some that have underpaid and might feel they're owed money by Revenue. There's confusion there too as to how you might go about securing that money. A lot of people are hard-pressed, Seamus. So it's about the handling of this going forward, is it? What's your advice to people? Is it to engage with Revenue? Because that's really what Revenue is seeking at this point.
Yeah, I think you need to engage in Revenue. Now, again, those who are, and not everyone is, and that's another criticism we have, digitally knowledgeable and educated.
Well, I don't like myself going into Ross or one of those websites. I mean, you constantly have to keep signing back in. There's texts to your phone. Yes. I understand how they have to be secure, but it is a nightmare. And if you take any time to think at all, you're signed out and you have to begin the whole process all over again. There's no end of years you can click, then forms you can click. I would see myself as competent. That whole system I see is a nightmare.
It's an absolute nightmare, and it's a very much a nightmare for people who are not used to the system. You're working at a computer probably every day, and the phone, and probably I am as well. But not everybody is, and especially people retired are simply not, and technology has even moved on since they were last at work. So they are nervous, and this is not. What we would like to have seen happen is this letter, first of all, it's written apparently as part of a batch of 200,000 letters on all to a whole load of tax people who may or may not be compliant. I would argue it should have been separated. I would argue in the letter, while it isn't the worst letter, it certainly isn't as bad as the one in 12, but it still lacks the assurance of what to do apart from ring revenue or go online. As you said, not everybody wants to go online. I would have said you should have equipped the citizens' online centres to handle all these queries, or at least given pensioners who have got this letter some way of contacting people who can actually physically and on the phone help them.
It's a confusion grenade. They've just chucked a confusion grenade into 200,000 people. It shouldn't be like this. Okay, and as you say, lessons should have been learned from 2012. Seamus, it's lovely to speak to you again. Thank you. Seamus Boland, CEO of Irish Rural Link. Now, this is relating to if you received a letter from Revenue. So if you are a pensioner and you hadn't, I presume this doesn't apply to you. Maybe you want to log on or inquire to see what the situation is. But people received a letter triggering this conversation. Some have overpaid tax. Many have underpaid tax. And it causes anxiety because you're thinking, right, well, I'm here. Yeah, I do have a contributory pension as well, but I'm just keeping my head above water. How much am I going to be on the hook for to Revenue? So those are the kinds of problems that people are going to encounter, the fears people may well have. Right, tomorrow's show, we're out of the studio, but you know yourself, the way we do it now, you wouldn't really know unless we told you. You can still listen to the show on air, of course, and watch the show online. We're coming live from the Vault Centre. It's operated by Rafoe Community in Action, and it's evolved into a vibrant community resource centre with space for classes, events and gatherings. So you'll be very clear, familiar with it if you go in there, but this is an opportunity perhaps if you're in the Rafoe area to come in and have a look at what it's all about and to listen to what it's all about, because lots goes on there. There's activities like yoga, Pilates, tin whistle lessons, senior clubs, youth drama, and groups like the Vault House Ladies and Diamond Writers. So we're going to have the Friday panel to kick things off. We're going to have live music, and we're going to chat to local communities and find out the work that they do. And we're also going to be launching our new cash draw, which is all very exciting. Is Sean coming out to Rafoe? He is coming out tomorrow. Oh, my word, the CEO. It's the red carpet in the back of the car. It is. Okay, great stuff. Yeah, so come along. It's going to be a lovely day. And as I say, an opportunity for you to see perhaps the work that goes on at the Vault. Even if you're in the area, sometimes you might not think, well, is that for me? Well, let's find out. We'll all find out together tomorrow. And as I say, if you want to come along and see how a show is put together and meet the crew, we'd be more than happy to see you too.